Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You spend the whole morning getting everyone else ready for the day. Thankfully, with Burt's Bees micellar towelettes, you only need a moment to freshen up and get ready for yours. Made with at least 70% upcycled cotton, these 3-in-1 wipes effectively and gently remove makeup, cleanse, and hydrate, leaving your skin with no oily residue. Available in coconut and lotus or rose water. Visit burtsbees.com to shop now. Burt's Bees. By nature. For nature. For all.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Tuesday, February 2nd, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. So today on 2-2 Tuesday, we're going to bid toodaloo to Iowa as we welcome New Hampshire. And don't worry, guys, I'm going to get to Iowa. We'll talk about Iowa. We'll talk to an Iowan Gist listener who caucuses. Just listeners who caucus on the next Gist. We'll also have Slate's Jamel Bowie on to talk about New Hampshire. But I want to take this space at the top of the show to reassure you that though I will be talking about elections a lot in the days to come, I will not ignore all the little things that make life worth living. The small flourishes that imbue our existence with worth, or even the small indignities that, when pointed out and puzzled over, bond us together. Like so many Martin O'Malley caucusers striving to achieve viability. Like Hieronymus Bosch. I love the guy. His paintings are dense and funny, and there's weird stuff going on everywhere. They're basically like a Marx Brothers movie or an airplane movie, but dark and weird. So like Zucker, Abrams, Zucker, and David Lynch. But they also include saints. So here's how art historian Nicholas Baum describes one little part of the most famous Bosch work called The Garden of Earthly Delights.
Those figures there, are they making love or copulating? Why three? Two might be respectable. Three's an orgy.
All right, you get the idea? Turns out the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City found a new Bosch. Heretofore anonymous, it turned out to be by Hieronymus. So there's St. Anthony. He's looking perplexed. There's a weirdo little funnel dude running around with a sword. His like whole body is covered by a funnel. He's very small. And in the background, there's Harpo stealing cutlery. It's just Hieronymus Boschkers. I have to say, the whole discovery of a rare work story, I'm supposed to get excited about this because it's rare. I don't. I do get excited about it because of the work. Like I say, I like Bosch. I look at this little painting. I wonder if the funnel guy is going to attack the fish with feet. I marvel at the fact that a painting from 1505 can inspire that same question that was also asked during an acid trip in 1975. And then I found out that the painting's 15 inches by 10 inches. This is a Bosch tweet. This is Bosch dropping a single, a one-off. There are only 25 Hieronymuses around, and I am glad they found another one, and I hope the funnel guy wins his duel. Okay, the show. The spiel's about Iowa, the interview's with Jamel Bowie, the first interview is with an actual Iowan. But then, in later days, we cleanse. The Iowa voter, once one of the most valuable substances on earth, now all but discarded. A little like whale oil or stock in Al Jazeera America. But I have on the phone with me an actual Iowa voter. He is Andy Frank. He is a faculty member at the University of Iowa, a Gist listener. He was tweeting to me during the caucuses. I want to see how it went. Hey, Andy.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
How long? Good. How long have you lived in Iowa?
6 years, pretty much exactly.
Okay, so this time you come in hoping to caucus for who?
I came to caucus for Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh. And were you dead set? Were you open? Because, you know, there's some persuasion element to a caucus. So were you open to other arguments?
No, I was not.
All right. So everyone, the doors open at what, 7 your time?
The doors open at 6.
No, all right.
The caucus was slated to start at 7. You were supposed to be in line by 7 or mm-hmm. so in order to be able to get in the door. Everybody got in the door by 8 or so. It was a long, long line.
Gotcha. So it's a college town, so I guess when they say, all right, all the Hillary people over here, all the Sanders people over there, there were more Sanders people?
Yes, exactly. There were more Sanders people. They had to squeeze on onto half of the basketball court right over the timeline, and they barely could.
Wow! Of all the political charges, the backcourt violation is one I haven't heard too much.
Exactly. No, I think they got over in time though. So.
Okay, so what's the persuasion aspect? Do people give speeches? Do people say, "Come over to my side"? How does that work?
Well, so. That was a little underwhelming in my first caucus here. There was not much in the way of persuasion that we were involved in, because we had about 859 people, I think was the total count, in the junior high gymnasium where our caucus was held. And there were, on initial count, I think 259 for Clinton, 569 for Sanders, and 17 for O'Malley.
Mm-hmm.
So O'Malley did not make the threshold. There were also some uncommitteds, of course. You do the math.
Yeah.
And O'Malley did not make the threshold, which was, I think, 15% of the people at the caucus in order to be viable. So his supporters and the uncommitted supporters were open to some caucusing or some persuasion. And that's sort of pandemonium. We had some leaders in the group that went to try and persuade them, and I think we did pick off a few of those O'Malley supporters to bump us up to 267. Not a big difference from 259, but that may have gotten Hillary Clinton another county delegate out of our caucus.
Right. So 259, hold on one second. 259, I'm going to do some math, plus 569 is, there are 828 total.
Yeah.
So if Hillary Clinton winds up with 259 out of the 828, that means that she should have, as a percent of the vote, 31. So how many, how did that actually work out?
In the end, after the reapportionment, Clinton ended up with 267 and Sanders ended up with 575. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's about right. She got about 31.7% of the vote, and Sanders got 68.2. So I think that that pretty much ended it right there. And there were 12 county delegates available to us based on previous elections.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the math shook out, Sanders got 8 and Clinton got 4.
Two-thirds, one-third. There you go.
Yeah, it seems a little unfair because Sanders got more than double her number of actual votes.
Right.
But that's how.
Right, that's how it works. And if you're in a college town, but I suppose that some gyms might have been just all students. Is that possible?
I guess that is possible. Depends if they're registered to vote in Iowa or here.
We have
a mix of people in this town. I mean, a lot of our students are from Iowa, but a lot of them are from Illinois. Some people come from outside of the U.S. So
if there's a place where there's only like 3 delegates available and Sanders gets 90%, he'd get all 3. I mean, this is why it doesn't,
yeah.
You're right, it doesn't work out per person, which from what I understand, I don't know if you read about the coin flips or knew about them at the time. They're not as important as maybe some people are saying, like, how is that fair? What if she had won different coin flips? You know, it's all kind of rough math from what I understand in Iowa.
Right. I think that's true. I read today that Bernie Sanders is asking that the official vote tally be released by the Democratic Party, because maybe in cases like ours where he got actually more than two-thirds of the votes but only two-thirds of the delegates, if that happened and projected out through the entire state like that, then he would get the official nod of having the highest vote tally, and he could use that narrative to springboard his campaign in New Hampshire.
Right, like Rick Santorum springboard his campaign.
Exactly. Well, that was interesting 4 years ago. It seemed like they didn't know who won at the time, either Santorum or Romney. That was a virtual tie. And then the actual winner ended up being Ron Paul, because his supporters stuck around and they got the county delegate seats and they got the state delegate seats. So
where'd you vote before? What states did you live in before Iowa?
I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. When I went to college, I was in Boston, and then I did a lot of my training in California, so I was in the Bay Area for 12 years before moving to Iowa.
Okay, so in those states where they have, there's certainly quirks to politics everywhere, like Nebraska has a unicameral legislature, but you've never...
Oh, yeah, you know
Sure, you've never been involved in a caucus, and Iowans always talk about, you know, what a great symbol of a certain kind of democracy it is, how stirring it is. What do you come away thinking about this? Is it a better form of democracy? Do you like the secret ballot? What do you think?
It is odd to have your friends and neighbors know who you're supporting and for that secret ballot to be taken away from you. It was also odd for my wife and I to have to shell out for babysitting so we could actually go to vote. It was an interesting date night at the caucuses with all of our friends and neighbors. But like many problems, we were able to solve the babysitting problem with lots of cash.
Yeah.
So I think it's certainly a lot more difficult than a regular primary. But maybe because Iowa's caucus is a unique and quirky, admittedly quirky aspect of our state, it'll keep us getting some attention for years to come.
You just gave me an idea, a once a quadrennial idea, which is caucus night babysitting service.
Yeah, that would, you could make a mint.
That's right. Talk about surge pricing. All right. Thanks so much. Andy Frank is a Just Listener who caucused for Hillary Clinton, who won possibly by his vote. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
Take care. Well, joining me now, hunkered down in a hotel that has just experienced a blizzard outside Des Moines, is Jamel Bowie. He is Slate's chief political correspondent. Hello, Jamel.
Hello, Mike.
Look, you and I are members of the media. I like to say there's no such thing as winning Iowa. You know, some delegates are at stake, and it turns out that Cruz, take the Republicans, won one more delegate than Rubio or Trump. But of course, it gets blown up to much bigger proportions. Put it in perspective for us. How important is this for Cruz, for Trump, and for Rubio?
So I think it's very important for Cruz because it essentially proves his theory of the race. It demonstrates that a dedicated conservative with an astonishingly strong organization can prevail. And while Iowa is fertile territory for social conservatives, there's no guarantee that he would be able to succeed. And so I think this vindicates his theory of the race. It shows a path forward for him for the next primary, sort of doubling down on plowing money and staff into beefing up an organization that can actually bring voters to the polls.
That's Cruz. I'll take Cruz.
Okay.
I am a bit skeptical. He is a one-term senator. He is said to have a great speaking style. I don't see that appealing to people who he's not already appealing to. I wouldn't think that his chances are so much better than Mike Huckabee's were, who was a successful governor and certainly had a lighter touch on the stump, if not actually less conservative ideas. He's probably a little bit better than Sam Torum. And I always look like Iowa gives, you know, there's an extra 5, 10, whatever percentage points it is to the evangelical candidate. Though on the other side, he's got a lot more money and a lot more access to money, and I am really impressed with his use of analytics and turnout the vote, which maybe can be replicated. So talk me off my general skepticism of Cruz going forward.
No, I think it's basically the right frame for thinking about it. He is a Huckabee-like candidate in terms of his appeal. The difference is that Huckabee didn't win hardcore conservatives. Just organization and fundraising makes Cruz a better bet for lasting through the whole process than Huckabee was. Let's jump down to Rubio because I think Rubio factors into what happens to Cruz next. Now, Rubio had a great night. He placed third place, but he overperformed the expectations. I am skeptical that this means he had a great night. I think he basically is where he needs to be to even have any viable path forward. But we'll just take the conventional wisdom for now and say he had a great night.
Okay, now let's talk Trump, the man who says he just might buy a farm in Iowa, even though the voting shows he kind of did. All right, here's the conventional wisdom as I see it, and I'll tell you where I agree and disagree. One, they say this hurts him because his brand is that of a winner and he just lost. I agree with that. I don't know how much it hurts him, but it certainly seems to hurt him. Two, people say he was stupid to have skipped the debate. We don't know that. Three, people talk about how his style of doing huge events, instead of talking to people one-on-one and going to diners hurt him. Again, I don't know that we could prove that. I mean, if any other candidate could book a 10,000-seat arena, wouldn't they? Still talking to people. But four, his ground game get-out-the-vote efforts seemed a little bit of a shambles, and I think that it really was, and that did really hurt him. So those are 4 points. Tell me if you agree with those points and the conventional wisdom or anything else you want to say about thinking about Trump going forward.
I agree with those points. It's sort of, I'm of two minds on Trump. First, given that no one actually knew if there were any Trump voters, the big question was, are these people who actually, and remember with the caucus, it's not a secret ballot. People can see you stand and give your support to Trump. And so the question was, is this protest voters, are these people saying in polls, yeah, I'll support Trump, but when it comes to actually stand in front of their friends and neighbors, they will go ahead? Or are they real supporters? And they are real supporters. There are actual Republican voters, a substantial number of them, who will back Trump. And I think this is being underplayed because Trump was leading and because he didn't win, it means he must have lost. But I think this is very significant. And what's interesting to think about is if Trump endures through these next couple primaries, who does he hurt more? I think the instinct to say he hurts Cruz more because they kind of are trying to capture a similar affect in terms of Republican voters, mm-hmm. who are angry with the establishment. But if you drill down into the people who support Trump, they are who you would describe as Republican moderates. They do not hold especially conservative views, but they are very skeptical of immigration and of foreign intervention. And I think that can cut against establishment candidates who are hoping to bring some of those moderates into the fold.
And now when it comes to the Democratic side, my big issue is we'll get to New Hampshire, and that'll be interesting and tell us a lot. But you know what? Let's get to a place where some black people are voting, because that is a quarter of the Democratic electorate, and that's really big. And I'm not saying it's impossible for Bernie Sanders to start showing support beyond Killer Mike, Run the Jewels. Because, you know, as you know, Obama wasn't doing great among black voters until he started winning and showed that he could win. But I'm saying until we see Latino voters in Nevada, black voters in South Carolina, a large portion, twice as big in the Democratic election as in the country at large, there's a huge asterisk to all these results.
So to back up real quick, I think one of the big misconceptions of the 2008 primary is this idea that Hillary Clinton crashed and burned. But if you actually look at the results of that primary, Hillary Clinton won a slight majority of the popular vote and was just behind Obama in the delegate count. Had Clinton been smarter about delegate strategy, and by smarter I mean had she had a delegate strategy in the first month and a half of the primaries, she probably would have won the nomination. And so Bernie Sanders has to essentially either outperform Obama in terms of campaign organization and winning votes. That means in places that are friendly to Bernie Sanders, he has to run up the score in a huge way. And in places that are unfriendly to Bernie Sanders, he has to minimize the losses. He has to do that or Clinton has to make a huge stumble. I don't see the latter really happening. Now, to say that Sanders will likely lose doesn't say anything about how that will happen. And we can still have a very long primary season extending to the very end, even if Hillary Clinton's going to win it in the end. And my sense is that Democrats should probably want that outcome,
mm-hmm.
just because it is a chance to organize voters and contact voters and activate voters in every single state and in every single competitive state. And that gives you a good leg up for the general election.
Right. And so here's my last question. I was just looking at the Betfair markets. They essentially have Bernie Sanders as 5-1 to win the nomination, a little higher. So it's looking like they're saying that Hillary Clinton has about an 85% chance to win the nomination. And on the Republican side, Marco Rubio has jetted up to about a 2-1. So they're saying he has about a 50-50 chance to win the nomination. Do you think those odds are right, or do you think that there's any value on the board?
I think that's reasonable. My hunch is probably that Cruz is a bit underrated to the nomination, and I would probably oppose by Cruz. And I would, you know, just because I would probably buy Bernie just in case. Never know what could happen. But otherwise, I think that's right. I think Rubio is 50-50. I think Clinton is heavily favored.
Jamel Bowie not only giving us his political insight, but telling us how his retirement portfolio is arrayed. Thank you, Chief Political Columnist for Slate, Jamel Bowie. Thanks a lot, Jamel.
Thank you, Mike.
And now the spiel of coins and caucuses. I have one wish, one overriding wish about Iowa. It's too late now. But just that we talk about it differently. The media, the candidates too, they just have thrown the empirical out the window and everything's subjective. Claims about momentum and upsets. And even claims about winning Iowa. There's no such thing as winning Iowa. Cruz wins. Yeah, he won 8 delegates. Trump loses. Actually, he won 7 delegates. Rubio outperforms. He also won 7 delegates. I'm not so naive as to say that there shouldn't be any attention paid beyond the actual accrual of delegates. But did Hillary win? Did Bernie win? The question, if coins were tossed differently, would someone else have won? Let me address the coin toss thing. This actually happened in a few of the caucuses. It is true that Hillary won 6 out of 6 coin tosses. By the way, the odds of that one candidate winning all 6, it's only about 3%. Someone's going to write in. They're going to tell me, Mike, it's below 1%. No, it's not. You do the math again. It's 1/2 to the 5th. Anyway, people are saying, oh, wait, 6 delegates. That's about her margin of victory. If the coins had gone the other way, Bernie would have won. That's not true. Because the coins determine representatives to a county convention, and then it's from the county convention that there's this state convention. So it's the number of coin tosses won was not the margin of victory. But that doesn't really matter. Bernie lost by very little. He didn't lose by the coins, but he lost by very little. But the bigger point is he didn't lose. It's proportional. He's coming out of Iowa with either the exact same number of delegates or maybe one fewer delegate than Hillary Clinton. By the way, those delegates that I just talked about, those are delegates to the Democratic National Convention. Oh my God, there are more delegates in that last paragraph than at the bathroom during a break at the UN. So look, you heard my show. You heard what I said to Jamel, to the Iowan. Iowa matters. It matters some. Trump losing matters. The Cruz win doesn't propel him to anything, but it certainly matters. And yes, I've made the analogy that the number of delegates accrued is the proportional equivalent to one play in a football game. That is true, 8 delegates out of 1,237 delegates to win the nomination. But I know that Iowa matters more than one play in a football game. But I wish the media would put it in some perspective. Like, let me lay a couple examples on you. You know how, let's say there's an axe murderer guy, and he's waving the bloody axe around, and he put that video up on Facebook, and he bragged about how he's the guy who chopped someone's head off with an axe. The media still calls this guy the alleged axe murderer, because that's the construct. Or how, when they deal with polls, every reporter always says it's within the margin of error, and that's outside the margin of error. There's such telegraphed prudence about margin of error. You could tell they don't really understand what margin of error means or how it has to do not that much with polling inaccuracy. But anyway, that's the construct. You always talk about the margin of error. And I'd like there to be a construct about the Iowa caucuses of saying, now we say wins, but to be clear, no one really wins. But I'd like a similar construct around the Iowa caucuses to say once in a while, now to be clear, it's all proportional and no one technically wins the Iowa caucus. They maybe earned one more delegate. Because if you don't say it like that, you're actually getting the election wrong. There are some other things they got wrong.
So the big question is, how many people are going to turn out?
That was Mara Liasson, who I really like, yesterday on NPR. Here's how she put it today on NPR.
Once again, conventional wisdom about this year's election was proved wrong. Turnout was way up, but it didn't push the two outsiders, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, over the top.
So on Monday, you just say that turnout matters. And on Tuesday, you say that the conventional wisdom about turnout mattering was wrong. Here are some other things that were wrong. All the entrance polls, they said Cruz was going to come in third. All the poll polls, which said that Trump was leading. Or maybe they weren't wrong. Maybe they're just a snapshot in time. So does that mean everything that we thought we knew was wrong? No, though that's what you'll hear. You'll hear people asserting that, You know, this means that Trump can't win just by drawing huge crowds. Let me ask you this. If Jeb Bush could pack a hockey arena, don't you think Jeb Bush would pack a hockey arena instead of going table to table at the Red Arrow Diner? Although the Red Arrow Diner is delicious. It's a little like that complaint about Hillary Clinton. It's a coronation. It seems like a coronation, so the criticism goes, because she seems like a very strong candidate. She shouldn't be less strong. It's not in her interest. Trump could draw smaller crowds. It's not in his interest to do so. One loss, Mike, it's not a loss. That's true. One fewer delegate in Iowa does not mean that everything that Trump did was wrong. Of course, the other candidates always brag about doing all those little things like going to the diners and going to 99 counties and meeting everyone one by one. Candidates brag about some pretty strange things. Like, here was Marco Rubio.
So this is the moment they said would never happen.
They said you'd never come in third? Who said that? I mean, I guess some people were saying you were going to win. I guess those guys owe you an apology. Go for the bronze, Marco Rubio is tattooed on his lower back. Then there's Ted Cruz, who was bragging about just how little his donors give.
800,000 contributions at tedcruz.org with an average contribution of $67.
Maybe you should know that one guy, a single guy, a hedge fund guy, Robert Mercer, has donated over $11 million to Ted Cruz super PACs. And anyway, if you really want to brag about people giving you money and how paltry their donations are, you can't get in a flame war with the burn, man.
It was $27.
Wait, you want to give me more? Don't give me more. You'll ruin my math. What are you, a billionaire? Oh, you are a billionaire? Well, here's Ted Cruz's address. Maybe he'll take your money. We want 27. If you give 29, find a guy to give 25. The math works out. These billionaires. But back to Cruz. He was interrupted by Hillary Clinton. So I went back and I listened to his whole speech. He thanked everyone in Iowa. No, I mean by name. The speech took 25 minutes. I cannot play the whole thing here. But here is a condensed version that Andrea whacked together with just the important parts that explain Ted Cruz's appeal to Iowans.
God bless the great state of Iowa. To God be the glory. Our rights come from our Creator. Morning is coming. Morning is coming. I want to remind you of the promise of Scripture and the Judeo-Christian values that built this great nation.
So on to New Hampshire, where they replace coin flips with pancake flips, and where the exit of Huckabee and O'Malley will really clear the field to talk about the big issues, like God. So that's it for today's show. We're on Facebook.com/SlateGist. We tweet also at SlateGist, and I tweet at PescaMe, which is PescaMI, because I didn't really understand how Twitter would work out when it started. Anyway, they said Andrea Salenzi couldn't be the Gist producer because her hair wasn't gray enough and her boots weren't high enough. Steve Lickteig is disqualified from being executive producer of Slate Podcasts because he thinks he's above the law. Andy Bowers can either be a greater chief content officer of the Panoply Network than he's ever been, or he could be the chief content officer of the Panoply Network in decline. The Gist. We have a late-breaking correction from the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City. Casey, who we have an in with, writes to us. We've had the piece since 1935 and bought it as a Bosch. It was then downgraded to by the school of Bosch. You know, could have been done by an acolyte. But now it's been elevated to by the hand of Bosch. So if it was bought as a Bosch, I was wrong. I'm correcting myself. It was not heretofore anonymous. It was heretofore eponymous, but still by Hieronymus. Umperu deperu duperu, and thanks for listening.